Whether you're focused on finding the perfect paper stock for a new travel title, or sourcing the best illustrators to capture your unique perspective, the process of publishing a magazine stretches far beyond the mere confines of the printed page. We'll be talking about that here today on The Stack. On today's programme, we're crunching the numbers at home and abroad as we consider what's ahead for the publishing industry.
You do not want to be on the iPad newsstand and you create your own app. You know exactly username and passwords for the people. You know what they're doing, how long they're spending. Basically, you control everything the reader is doing in your platform because it's your platform.
Plus, we speak with Monocle's editor-in-chief with a couple of updates from the European presses.
You'd love this cover. It's kind of a soft magenta. It's a Zeit magazine, mit Liebe gemacht, and it's Barbara Papa figures throwing love hearts at each other.
That and more ahead here on today's edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now, before we get underway today, let's check in with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. As it's April, there's a fair chance he's probably in Souterol checking out the newsstands, among other things. Tyler, welcome to The Stack. Is that a fair summary of what you're up to right now?
It's a fair summary, Tom. You can probably hear the bird song in the background.
Lovely.
I would say we're probably a good 2 months ahead of London when it comes to being properly into what we classically would think of as springtime, birdsong included, blooming gardens, particularly here, of course, all of the apple orchards in full white bloom. It's springtime.
It sounds beautiful, Tyler. Now, obviously, a lot of minds and eyes focused on Milan, though, for next week. We've got the Furniture Fair, Salone del Mobile, of course. And I know that some of the newsstand offer there is, likewise, turning its attentions Milanwards.
Absolutely. So when you go to the newsstand, and just as we were entering the weekend, you saw, of course, a lot of the big German papers. I'm looking at Die Zeit right now. Everyone knows that there's normally a bit of a battle in our office on a Thursday when Die Zeit comes in from Germany, because everyone wants to get their hands on the supplement. And this week's supplement, it's got a very, you wouldn't sort of say it's a classic design cover. They've done away, Tom, with their classic Zeit magazine logo, and they've actually gone for a bit of a Barbara Papa moment. Do you recall Barbara Papa?
Oh, absolutely. You probably heard from my chuckle. I loved Barbara Papa, yeah.
Well, you'd love this cover. It's kind of a soft magenta. It's a Zeit magazine, mit Liebe gemacht, and it's Barbara Papa figures throwing love hearts at each other. And then they've done a second cover, and of course, so the inside front cover to the big Italian brand Minotti sofas, and they managed to sell a second cover to Baxter Sofas of Italy. So I think it's clever from an art direction point of view. It's also very smart from a revenue generation point of view as well.
Well, and it's amazing, isn't it, Die Zeit? There's such a richness of offer. Another thing we often look out for is some of the English language offer. There's the sort of biannual publication that's out now. What do you make of that?
Well, it's always great. And so this is a distillation of everything that they've done over the last 6 months. They take the best of the magazine, and there's always so many quirky things you wish, if only I did another year of German. And of course, we can stumble through it, or we can call upon the likes of our Matt Alagai or Marie Sophie in our office to translate these things. But it's great because most of the stories that you really love, they do end up in this biannual. So that's also out now. So you don't get scared just because it has a Zeit magazine title strap across it. It's open to everyone who speaks English. And it's a great read. It's long reads. It's visually interesting. There's great fashion in it. And they do a great job. I have really enormous respect for everyone there, both editorially on their art desk as well.
I'll second that, Tyler. What about the some of the Italian language press that's kind of at your fingertips right now? I know that Corriere della Sera has its Io Donna magazine supplement. Another one that you admire?
Yeah, they've actually done something interesting. So this is one of the amazing things, because I think oftentimes, Tom, there's so much focus on the English language supplements, and people talk up the supplements in the UK, or of course we spend a lot of time talking about WSJ, or How to Spend It, or Key Magazine. But the Italians have really, they continue to innovate. They were the first to bring out these dedicated women's weekly magazines. You have La Repubblica with their D magazine, and then Corriere, as you said, has Io Donna. So it normally comes in a staple. It's a big issue. It'll be a perfect bound edition. But what they've done for spring is they've just done this very large tabloid format, and it's on newsprint, so it's not really in the format of a traditional magazine, and it's just a great celebration of spring, and it is just, you know, page after page, full bleed, you know, doing, you know, using the proper real estate of a newspaper and newsprint to do just a fantastic opening fashion story. Again, a big pictorial piece at the beginning, as opposed to, of course, many magazines and newspapers go for sort of a slightly bittier opener, lots of newsy stories, and they've done away with that. But they've also thrown out the mix, I would say, from an art direction and pacing point of view.
Now, Tyler, spring is a time, you know, traditionally, of course, for rebirth, a bit of resurrection as well. And there's a title from Axel Springer, which has had a bit of new life breathed into it, and the new Allegra magazine, back in the German language again.
Yes, exactly. And it's a title which oddly has a couple of roots, even in Midori House, because our Ariel Childs, who, of course, oversees Wing Creative, our branding and design sister company, she was one of the creative forces there not too long before it went quiet, and that title went away. So for whatever reason, and I don't have sort of the commercially, but I can say that our Fernando Augusto Pacheco, we're in touch with them, and you'll be hearing a proper feature that we're going to be doing on Allegra. But I just got my hands on a first copy. I would say it's aimed at a woman, Tom, who is probably early 20s to early 30s, I think, is probably a little bit more sophisticated in their fashion tastes. It feels very much to me like a magazine which they want to champion a different type of photography. Let's say they're not in a grazia world. The way that they also approach, let's say, living and architecture, you get the sense that this is probably someone, yes, who wants to have great accessories and a great wardrobe, but it's also a young woman who's thinking about, you know, what is my first home going to look like? Or, if I'm going to buy a first home, will I continue to rent in town? But maybe I want to buy a great little fixer-upper shack somewhere on the North Sea, or maybe somewhere in an emerging country along the Mediterranean. So it's got that sense of aspiration, but somehow it's also rooted in some sense of reality. And I have to say, if I survey the U.S. or U.K. newsstand, the Australian newsstand, we really don't have anything like this. So it makes me think that maybe Axel Springer, a company which has big international ambitions, as we know, just before Christmas, well, they didn't get their hands on the Financial Times, but they did buy Business Insider. I'm wondering whether that they're gearing this up to have a number of international editions.
Interesting thoughts, Tyler. Now, what's next for you? You'll be heading to Milan, as we mentioned. Will you be? Will your paths cross with some of our quite a large staff that we're going to have in the city for Salone during the next week or so?
Indeed, yes. Well, I'm leading the run on Tuesday morning and on Thursday morning. As you said, there's going to be quite a contingent. I think we're about seven or eight editors in Milan. We've anyone who's seen the April issue so far, of course, you might have noticed a very fine, handsome-looking supplement we've done with Nike. Well, that ties in with, and Tom, I'm going to throw it to you to talk a little bit more about maybe what we're doing audio-wise. All I can say is I'm tying up my sneakers. I'm leading the run on Tuesday morning. Thursday morning, I could be doing it, but my flight to Vienna leaves a little bit too early to get to our conference. But I know I will be around the microphone doing a number of other things, because we've got quite a big audio lineup from there as well.
That's right. We've got not only lots of kind of live crosses bringing the views of our correspondents and editors, as you mentioned, Tyler, on our news programs. But yeah, I'll show the rundown with Nike. It's a bit of a design and running guide. Two in one. It's a value add, Tyler, for the city. So if you want to know the great spots to run, to get some exercise, to clear your head away from the mayhem in the sort of fairgrounds of Milan, it'll be the perfect spot all through that week on Monocle 24. So I know you'll be tuning in, won't you, Tyler?
I will be tuning in. I'm sure I'm going to be listening to the final cut. And, you know, it's great. I mean, we've designed this and developed it as something which, you know, people are going to be out at Barbasso late the night before. They might not have heard all the gossip. They may not have been able to see all of the shows. So this is something you can ease your way into Milan the next day, sort of pounding around whatever park you choose. Or, of course, you know, this is made for international audience. Many of our listeners are not going to be in Milan. So you can get a complete design over you as well. It's as good as having Josh Fennert actually reading every word out of his D section to you as you pad around your favorite park.
And who wouldn't want to hear that? Tyler, thanks for being with us. As always, that's our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. We'll be hearing from him, as he mentioned, from Milan next week here on Monocle 24. Tyler, thanks for being on The Stack. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and I'd like to issue a warm welcome to my studio guest today, Alex Wish from Bloomberg Intelligence. Alex, great to have you back with us.
Indeed. Hi.
On The Stack. Always good to talk to you. We're going to talk a bit about, you know, some forecasts. We'll look ahead a little in a moment or two. But I guess if we look back or look around at some trends right now in publishing, are the same things intriguing you now as, say, I don't know, 18 months ago? Or are there sort of new things that are influencing your thinking right now?
I think the new trend is basically, for me, is how big is mobile advertising? Because basically we were so worried about digital taking over from print, and that's a multi-year trend. But now digital itself, when you go to online publications, they're also losing share to mobile publications. So basically maybe we will come full circle. So we go from print to digital, digital now being mobile, and then from mobile we may go back to print.
Well, I guess then this brings us back to something that's been a real issue, something of a sticking point. A lot of traditional publishers, if you want to call them that, have stuck to their guns somewhat. Many have said, or maybe it's forward-thinking companies have stuck to their guns and said, look, you know, we believe in the power of print, it's enduring. Advertisers understand what that offer is and how they're reader engages with it. We understand what it is and how the advertising fits in with our model. Are we starting to see the rewards being there in terms of revenue, in terms of partnerships with enlightened brands for publishers who said, look, we're not going to adopt that herd mentality. We'll stick to our guns and we'll go with traditional models that have enduring value?
I think for the mainstream, they're lagging behind. I don't think, I think people are still buying the trend, even if they don't reap the benefits. And I think that will struggle to get there. But what is also happening, and I think that's happening at the fringes, is understanding the value of a brand. So I think whether you're print or digital, there's value in the brand. We've seen that in massive premium paid for key publications like the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal a few years before. And I think that you understand that the value of the publication is not just the advertising that you generate, be it on print or online, but the value of the community of readers that you have in any platform you may have. But it's a value of the reader that you're attracting. So the value of the brand is more on the community around your brand than the advertising revenues that you may generate on print, digital, or mobile. And I think the successful media companies in the future are companies that actually do just that. They build a community around the brand. If you have a strong community around the brand, they will follow you in whichever platform you are.
I think that's really interesting. And obviously, I think that idea of building this community around the brand is something, I don't know, even in-house here at Midori House, you know, it's fundamental to Monocle's models across the different strands of the business. But I'd like to ask you, Alex, is that sector specific? Because it seems almost an easier sell, maybe in the premium sector, if we're talking about luxury advertising, for example, people are more willing to get on board with that idea of a community, of a bigger picture around the brand. Maybe it's harder for mass market advertisers, or would you not make that decision?
Yes or no. I wouldn't say premium versus non-premium. My distinction would be community, specific community versus generalist. So I think the generalist will struggle So this is not a just basically having a luxury magazine or a luxury content for luxury buyers. That doesn't exist anymore. I think we're moving to an era where the communities are more mobile, are more flexible, and the distinctions, there are new emerging communities that I think traditional media companies have failed to capture. So you can have the young affluent hipster as a community that you can target in different ways. They have different buying patterns, and they have different media consumption patterns. And basically, there are some communities out there that we are failing to reach. And that's a huge opportunity for clever media owners, content producers, to tap on those communities and build them and do something with them. And that's very appealing to advertisers. It was appealing back then when we just had more basic communities, sort of like affluent urban dwellers. And it's still very valid today.
I guess this comes back to that word we mentioned briefly earlier, which is engagement and how you engage. It becomes something of a buzzword. I wonder sometimes whether people almost lose track of the real meaning of it. I guess one thing which is important is to drill down into the data. What do the actual numbers tell us? Now, you said earlier it can be still quite hard to read the data in some of these newer platforms, or the mobile platform, which is changing very quickly. What about going right back? You know, if you look at, say, simple figures on, I don't know, newsstand sales, numbers of physical units going, is that still as important to be on top of as ever, even if the overall numbers may be declining of, say, certain periodicals? Is that important to keep a grasp of that?
I think any metric is better than no metric. So, you know, whether you're going to give me the circulation numbers, but increasingly the softer measures are as important. Time spent in article. And the beauty, I mean, one of the problems that print has had is basically on digital, because you leave a digital trace, it's easier to measure. So one of the key selling points of digital versus print has been, well, we can measure how long people hovered at a certain advert and whether they clicked or did not click. And you cannot do the same thing on print. So they supply more data than we have on print. Now, when you get to engagement, and engagement meaning the actions triggered by the presence of my content, of the either the advert or an article that I read, the action taken on print is a bit softer to measure. And I think we're still lagging behind in basically being able to put a number on it. So we can measure things like hours spent on each device, hours spent per media. And the trend is that we are spending more time online and we are spending more time on mobile. But does it equate to actually action based on an advert scene on a mobile device? So how engaged or how likely are you to take action on a mobile advert that you saw on a Facebook scroll while entering a tube station in London? And how much more engaged could you be if you were reading an airport magazine when you were stranded somewhere? So the question is, it's not just newsstand circulation, it's not just clicks, it's basically maybe, and this is something that we cannot yet measure, actions taken after perceiving an advert. And I think we may go back to basically traditional panels, you know, discussing brands among consumers. I think if we go back there to the traditional way of monitoring performance of the brand, we may see that basically traditional print is very, very effective.
We'll drink to that here at Midori House, Alex. Just on that point, though, about sort of controlling the brand and making sure that how the brand is presented remains very coherent, which is obviously critical for safeguarding a brand that in some cases has taken generations to build. If this sort of marketplace becomes or continues to be very fragmented, quite fractured, you know, mobile, it can be very disparate, it can be hard to know exactly what's where, when. Is that a challenge then in terms of safeguarding the brand? Is there a risk that, okay, you might get the clicks, but you don't know who's clicking, you don't know where that's appearing? Is there a risk for maybe marketers to almost lose control over some of that brand integrity?
Yes or no? I think that I think we do know who's clicking, but the question is, who knows that? Facebook knows that. Is Facebook sharing that with the advertisers? Not necessarily.
So you find maybe for a premium, right?
Yeah. But or they may not want to share everything with the advertiser. Mm. So what I'm hearing from talking to these companies is, for example, that Google is much more open in sharing that information with the advertiser. Facebook is less. And there are valid reasons for that. But I think it may backfire. So I think we do have a lot of data about what people are doing when they're clicking on digital publications. The question is, can we access it? Do advertisers have access to that? Can they measure, monitor, and basically take decisions based on that data? And I think there we're a bit far behind. So until we get there, I think a lot of the advertising decisions are a bit blind.
Mm. That's the insights of Alex Wish from Bloomberg Intelligence. Alex is going to stay with us here on The Stack, and we'll be talking to him more about some of these trends in advertising and in revenue generation for brands in publishing later on in the programme.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Alex Wish from Bloomberg Intelligence is still with me. Alex, we talked a little bit earlier in the show about how brands have grappled with some of the challenges of digital first, then mobile, this sort of thing. Some interesting recent examples of companies who have maybe gone big with, you know, iPad versions, this sort of thing, maybe backtracking somewhat. Is it too early to read into that it's a across the market trend? You know, do we just need to look at these as isolated cases? Or do you think, you know, people are starting to review that strategy en masse now?
Are you referring to the case of, for example, the stylist that basically closed the iPad brand?
Mm. Well, I mean, because that would have seemed, you know, unthinkable, possibly, I don't know, even only 18 months ago. And yet now it kind of didn't. It doesn't necessarily surprise people, which is an interesting shift.
I think we have a battle, and it's a battle that we had in print and we're having on digital, is basically the distribution platform and the content owners. What happened is that on print, when you distribute your magazines and newspapers, you can go to newspapers, you can in the UK, you can go to WH Smith, you can go to independent newsstands. So you have a myriad of possibilities to distribute your content. What's happening on digital is you have a huge concentration. So you rely a lot on what Apple or Amazon are willing to give you, or the pricing structure that they're willing to support, and the data that they're willing to give you to help you with your publication, on how open they are to sharing their platform and helping you in your product. So I think what we're seeing is that a lot of content providers are upset, and rightly so, for the lack of competition among platforms. And I think until we have more competition there, we may see a huge backlash there. And I think that the stylist decision is just basically one more. Even before that, we saw the Financial Times removing, even before any issues there, they removed their application from the newsstand on iPad, and they had an independent app. And the reason for that is they wanted to control their readers in their own way.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because I often think back to, say, you know, the great press barons, and you'd have these models where companies would literally control every stage of the supply chain, from, you know, even having their own paper mills and paper plants, certainly through to their distribution operations being in-house, the newsstands being in-house or part of, you know, under the umbrella of a big conglomerate. Is it possible then, you mentioned a couple, the FT, for example, to see companies, even in the digital age, trying to, in a sense, replicate that model and controlling all of the, you know, the means of production, if you like, the means of distribution too, and the point of sale? Or are we still, again, are we maybe a generation away from
well,
that being realistic?
Well, the Financial Times went to some extent did that. Basically, you do not want to be on the iPad newsstand, and you create your own app. And that means that basically you know exactly username and passwords for the people. You know what they're doing, how long they're spending. Basically, you control everything the reader is doing in your platform because it's your platform. Mm. You're still on the iPad, but it's your own app. It's not basically dependent on the iPad newsstand. Mm.
Do you think that's partly an issue of almost trust, respectively, between, you know, the media brand and their consumers? You know, they want people to feel confident that their information is safe, that they're not going to be barraged by inappropriate content, that it's a bit more, you know, tailored, you know, a bit more, I hate using the word again, but it's a bit more curated for them by editors, for example, that they know and trust.
Let's put it this way. If you have great content, people will come. Mm. So the question is, have content that's interesting for a niche audience, for your people, for your community. And I think that when you have that, people will come to you in whichever platform you have. And they can even go back to print. If you have something that's interesting, engaging, I think people will come to you. What's happening is that some of these distribution platforms are not enabling that to happen. Mm. And I think that's where we may see a backlash. We have seen that also in books publishing. Books publishing is another area that's controlled by basically, again, Apple and Amazon. And the problem there is some of the book publishers are not able to put the pricing right for the books, for the content that they are generating. So we've seen in the US last year, for example, company that I follow in Lagardère, book publishing in the US, e-books publishing for them was down. So you think, oh, it's all going digital. Well, it's not. Not for them. It's not the right business at the right price. And they're struggling with e-books in the US and the UK. So if we don't have the proper structure that allows publishers, big in books, or being it in magazines and newspapers, to price the product right and to reach the right audiences the right way, I think we may see a backlash there.
Alex, I just wanted to pick up on another point. We talked about, you know, the challenges of new technology, of understanding it properly, understanding its impact. And if we look at something like, you know, on mobile platforms, ad blocking. Now this is quite important because obviously people talk, as we have done already, I mentioned a couple of times, about, you know, the ability to reach people, to engage. If you like, conflicting technologies where you can block the advertising almost as easily, or in some cases more readily, than you can target the reader or listener that you're chasing, how much of a problem is that? Is it a technological battle alone, or is there a commercial or editorial influence?
I think it's a cultural battle. I think there are differences in different countries, and it depends on how digitally cultured you are or digitally aware you are. So you have some countries where people are basically not even aware that every time you go into a website, you might get a cookie at the back end. So in some other countries, you're very conscious about your digital rights and wrongs. Mm. So countries like Germany, for example, is a country where people are very conscious about the digital footprint. So I think it's a cultural issue about the digital rights and identity. And another issue that we may have is a generational issue. So the older generation is not even aware that it's happening. And the younger people that are more digitally educated or digital natives in many ways, they are more aware of their impact on the digital footprint. So it depends on the country and it depends on the generation. But I think a longer term, of course, we will have more awareness and the ad blocking will become a major issue for the advertising industry.
Alex, I feel we could talk all day, but I think we need to leave it there. That's Alex Wish from Bloomberg Intelligence. Alex, thanks very much for being with us here on The Stack.
Thank you.
And that's all for this week's programme. My thanks to our producers, Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editor, Claire Urban. Comments or queries, as always, are welcome. Direct them to info@monocle.com. And don't miss the show when it returns at the very same time next week. You can always listen again if you're worried you're going to miss us before then. Head to monocle.com or listen via your preferred platform. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in.